Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
The Telegraph Total Football Podcast, in association with Lion Trust, specialist fund managers.
Hello and welcome to Total Football. I'm Ian Irving off the bench once again whilst Tom Gibbs is away to look over the weekend's action and look ahead to another big week for English clubs in Europe. On today's episode, we look at the mayhem in Manchester, where Ole turned to dismay at the Etihad as Pep's party was put on hold by United. We'll head to Merseyside, where there were no goals and no joy for Everton, held at home against a distracted Liverpool team with one eye on Europe. Meanwhile, at the other end of the table, it's as you were, with no wins for the bottom clubs. We'll ask Kelly Cates her thoughts on the relegation scramble. Well, only one place to start, really, and I'm joined by the chief football writer here at The Telegraph, Sam Wallace, to unpick the Manchester derby. Sam, where do we start?
Well, I think we probably have to start at half-time, don't we? Because that's where the game changed. Mourinho said afterwards that he felt that the performance wasn't as poor as it was generally received to be in the first half. And
do you believe him?
To be honest, there wasn't much dissembling in that press conference. He didn't seem to be pushing an agenda at all. He didn't seem that sort of triumphant. So I'm gonna give him the benefit of the doubt and say that I do actually. He said that he told his three midfielders, Matic, Pogba, and Herrera, that they played well, and that all he asked of the team was that Lingard and Sanchez get involved more and connect the players. He said, and I think Sanchez's performance really probably, you know, was the spark if Pogba delivered the two goals. But I'm right in saying that Sanchez got two assists and had a key role in the first goal. So he saw the game slightly differently. He wasn't as kind of irritated as you might expect for a manager being two goals down in a game like that. So perhaps, you know, perhaps he's right. Perhaps he saw it slightly differently to us. It wasn't one of those games where when we think back to the victory over Liverpool where they targeted Lovren, it wasn't one of those games where, to the sort of layman, there's a tactical aspect that really stands out. I suppose you would say the fact that he didn't change, that he kind of sort of held his nerve through that first, well, through half-time and believed that things would change for him on the pitch with the same 11 players. Maybe that was what he did well this time. I have to say, it's amazing the confidence of even the top footballers, the difference that just a few things going well for them make. So I think it was, I was thinking, when's United's first attempt on target going to come? When are they actually going to make, you know, Edison make a save? And it was 4 minutes after half time, Pogba had a shot.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a very good one, but it was a shot. And suddenly just the mood changed a little bit.
That was a marker for what was about to come
exactly.
As well, wasn't it? Yeah.
So it always amazes me because, you know, you watch kids football, you know, you watch football at any level, confidence has such an effect. And once City wobbled, they really wobbled, didn't they?
Paul Pogba became the central figure before the game, before a ball had even been kicked, just from the press conference comments from Pep Guardiola. But he became central on the pitch as well in that second half. What did he do differently for you?
I thought he was getting passed around in the first half. I thought he made some bad decisions. There was a moment where we were talking earlier, where he just tried to dribble out of his own half and lost the ball. He just looked a bit lost, I thought. Judging by the fact the positions that he was in when he scored, he just seemed to be further up the pitch. And I think that really suits him. I think to have, you know, Matic and Herrera are naturally deeper players. And I just felt that he was further up the pitch. But Mourinho made no reference to that afterwards. Maybe United were just pinned back a bit. I actually thought United started the game quite well. But I remember glancing at my notes earlier, just about sort of 10 or 11 minutes, I'd made the note City have really settled into their rhythm now, and they were just running the game. United started okay. It was just, you know, it was just the sort of the last 40 minutes of the first half that were the problem for them.
When we talk about Paul Pogba and the comments that came from Guardiola before the game, obviously he's answered back with those two goals. But what about his future now? What's going to happen next? Because the cold hard facts underneath what Guardiola says was that his agent has been looking for an out from Old Trafford.
Yeah, there's no doubt that there's a difficult relationship between Mourinho and Mino Raiola. And Raiola is a salesman. He's like anyone else who sells advertising space or cars or whatever. He deals in trades. So he's always looking to create a market. I think what was more surprising about it all was Guardiola divulging it, because that's a tactic we associate with Mourinho.
Why did he do it?
I wasn't at the press conference, but the guys who were there say that he just came out with it, that he couldn't stop himself, and he just felt like saying it. And as you know better than I do, I mean, Guardiola doesn't always talk in complete sentences. So it does, and this is not meant to be a slight on a man who's speaks many more languages than I do. He does talk in a stream of consciousness, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And one idea overlaps another, overlaps another, overlaps another. And I just think it just spilled out, as it often does with Mourinho. Mourinho often says things that I think in reflection he'd wished he hadn't.
He didn't say anything in reference to this, though, did he? He didn't seem to make any sort of comment or any sort of snipe back. Yeah, Jose didn't.
Yeah.
Seems strange. That's like Jose light almost,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes. Because if Wenger had said it, I think he would have devoured him. I mean, some of his retaliations to stuff Wenger has said has been totally disproportionate, including the sort of specialist in failure remark, which really, the remark from Wenger that preceded it really didn't merit that kind of response. So I was surprised at that. I think he's probably put that one in his pocket, and we'll come back to that at a later date.
In terms of the result, James Ducker writing in the Sunday Telegraph was sort of alluding to this idea of it being a marker for next season, and that Manchester United have to make it more than just winning the 3 points and delaying City's title party. Do you buy into that?
I think United's problem this season and the euphoria of that result change it a great deal is what sort of team are they going to be? And I'm not really sure. And you know, the performance against Liverpool, when was it, October, I think, is always held up as the one that where they kind of lost their nerve a bit. I don't know what an attacking Mourinho team looks like. I didn't watch Real Madrid every week, but I watched his Chelsea teams most weeks. And they were, Chelsea Mark 1 was very kind of economic. It was 2-0 wins. It was a goal in either half and then they shut up shop. But they did play some good football. And then Chelsea Mark 2 was really changed by the 5-3 defeat at New Year's at White Hart Lane. So Mourinho would be bemused if people expected him to play football like Jurgen Klopp or Guardiola, because it's just not what he does, and he's not interested in doing that, and it's not what's brought him success. So what I'm curious as to here is, he's managing a club which is very different from Chelsea, which is certainly different from Porto and Inter Milan, and the only similar kind of comparable is Real Madrid in terms of his career. Mourinho thrives as the underdog. And even at Real Madrid, he could afford to be the underdog a little bit because he was up against a great Barcelona team. But what does he create at United? I'm not sure yet. I think a lot of it, of what he does, is always relative to the teams he's up against. So if he's up against that Liverpool team of 2013, 2014, he's about stopping them winning the league. If he's up against that City team of the current season, then it's about beating them. But how do United carve out their own identity as a club that where we talk about them in the way that we talk about City?
In terms of the result, The United players, speaking after the game, pointed out it was important in the battle for second place. There's obviously the elephant in the room and the fact that they've delayed a title party for Manchester City, maybe only for a week, but maybe for longer. But they've now lost the chance to break the record of the earliest ever title win. The winning margin could be smaller as well. They may not set that record. Does this result take any gloss away from their title victory?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, it sounds ridiculous to say that because most
really,
weeks it would have been monumental. It would have been like when Arsenal won the league at White Hart Lane. It would have been up there with all those things, those kind of achievements. So yeah, of course it takes a bit off it. But they are still, you know, by far and away the best team in the country, and that won't change. I kind of admire the fact that Guardiola doesn't change, he doesn't adapt, and he plays with the handbrake off. I quite like that, and I also admire the way that he accepted defeat. I thought he was very magnanimous. He has been for most of the season. I know he can be a bit awkward at times, but he didn't go on about that penalty, which was clearly a penalty, the young tackle on Sterling. You know, managers don't often get the credit for that sort of stuff. We only notice it when they do have a moan. So, yeah, I mean, back to the original question. Yeah, of course it does. It does take an edge off it, but it will still be a pretty remarkable title. And one thing that I'll just finish on this note. I was interested. I thought some of the City players had their children with them as mascots at the start of the game, and that just surprised me. Not because I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, wanting your children to be there. Guardiola is a kind of zero distraction sort of manager. Just surprised he allowed it. But there you go. It's a curiosity. Not all of them. I mean, the child that was at the front, who was brought out in a wheelchair by Vincent Kompany, that was obviously something different. But it just seemed to me that there was a lot going on the pitch before. There was a lot of who should I hand my toddler over to, and from a couple of the players. And Guardiola being so much about details and about not tolerating a single error or a digression from procedure, it just surprised me, that's all.
Two damaging defeats in a row. Obviously the first leg against Liverpool, now defeating the derby as well. How does Pep Guardiola lift things for this second leg now against Liverpool, Champions League quarter-final on Tuesday?
I think if they score the first goal, it all changes. I mean, I really do feel like it's that sort of, it's on that sort of knife edge, just like United coming out for the second half and scoring, when was it, sort of about 8 minutes in or whatever. I think it's really as simple as that. I think they get that first goal and suddenly the hunt is on and they can do it. And it's going to be Liverpool will be caught between going forward and defending what they've got. And I think it makes it really exciting. And that's the great thing about football. You can, you know, there's a game every 3 or 4 days when you're a top team, and you can transform your fortune so quickly.
It might help them, that, might it? The fact that it is so quick.
Yeah, they've not got much time to think, really, have they? And if there's one team that can do it, you know, you'd expect a side that scored as many goals as them that they could really cut loose.
We'll talk more about that game a little bit later with both Chris Bascom and Kelly Cates. But Sam, if we can move it on now to look at the picture in the Premier League that 0-0 draw's left between Everton and Liverpool, because we now have a bit of a battle really for second and third place. Tottenham now level on points with Liverpool after victory at Stoke. And Harry Kane not getting his goal, despite the fact he claimed it flicked off his shoulder. We said before, do you believe Jose Mourinho? Do you believe Harry Kane?
It's interesting that because Harry Kane is, you know, he's always the sort of nice guy, but he's obviously desperate to make up a bit of ground after his injury in this golden boot race, isn't he? No, I think that one, I think that's rightly Christian Eriksen's. And I think he may well struggle to catch Mohamed Salah now, won't he, Kane?
Is it a bit uncomfortable how selfish Kane is in this regard, because he's publicly stated quite openly that he wants this golden boot. As a teammate or as a Tottenham fan, I mean, I guess you want Kane to score goals and have that attitude, but is it not a little bit selfish?
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think footballers, the good ones anyway, care about that sort of stuff. And when you play the game at that level, the impression I get from talking to them is there's a different sort of set of rules at play there, that, you know, that however light that last touch might be, you know, it's yours. There's a great story, isn't there, about David Nugent, I think, scored one goal in one cap for England. and he nicked a Jermaine Defoe goal on
the goal line.
I don't think they ever spoke again after that.
Really?
That's what someone told me, yeah. And that's how serious it is. You know, these things matter to strikers.
Well, points are certainly mattering to Stoke at the moment as well. They're in a lot of trouble at the bottom of the table. Paul Lambert says if they continue to play like they did against Tottenham, they'll be okay. Do you buy into that?
They were, you know, judging by what I've seen of the game, they were unlucky, and they did play well. They gave them a game. I suppose what you would say is there's still a bit of time to go. I mean, Stoke have got 5 games left. I mean, Swansea in 15th is still only 5 points ahead of them. I think there's still a bit to play for down there, and I wouldn't say it's over yet. It's just that they're not going to be able, they're going to have to pull some results out of the hat, aren't they?
Southampton the same as well. They were at the wrong end of a crazy game against Arsenal, 3-2 victory.
Yes.
But Mark Hughes has had 2 Premier League games now, 2 defeats, 3 goals conceded in both matches. Things need to change quickly, don't they? 6 matches left. They've got Chelsea still to play. They've got Manchester City still to play. Tricky away games at Leicester and Everton. It's looking like an uphill task.
It is. It is. And their form, you know, is really, really poor. The last Premier League win was February the 3rd against West Brom, away at West Brom. I think they did look at this Arsenal game as one that, you know, they felt they could get something out of. Just obviously, you look at a fixture list and you see names like Arsenal and Chelsea, and you think, well, actually, you know, they're difficult games. But in reality, you've got to look at form. And clearly, next Saturday against Chelsea at home, yes, it's the last season's champions, but I see that as a game they just have to win. And it's not implausible. It's not like Chelsea are going for the title. Chelsea is struggling for a bit of form at the moment as well. I've got a feeling they're going to be okay. That's my belief, and I think it's going to be tight. But I think they will. I think they'll get something out of that Chelsea game. And I think, obviously, the Bournemouth game on the 28th of April, the home game against Bournemouth. That's another South Coast team, although not really a rivalry.
Quite a long way between the two. Yeah,
it's not really. I mean, people have tried to dress it up as the New Forest derby. It's nothing. There's not a lot of hatred there, but nothing like there is with Portsmouth and Southampton. But that game, they've got to win that.
From the Arsenal perspective, of course, they've got their quarter final in the Europa League, the second leg, 4-1 up against CSKA Moscow, going to Russia. Danny Welbeck was a standout player in the game for Arsenal, 2 goals and assist, and an horrendous miss. What do you make of him? And he's sort of making a run for the England squad again, isn't he?
Yes, kind of against the odds, really. England managers, I mean, Roy Hodgson was a massive fan of his and played him a lot, especially in that first Euros in 2012. The problem is obviously the finishing. I mean, that's always been held against him. He's never been viewed as a clinical striker, but he tends to be played out wide most of the time anyway, doesn't he? And he follows instructions, and managers really like that. I mean, Arsenal are on, actually, I mean, for all their sort of problems there, I'm just looking at their form, and that was a 6th straight win, wasn't it? So they're on a bit of a run at the moment. I mean, the season's sort of turned on its head, really. I mean, I was there at the start for that Europa League campaign, and Wenger was, you know, got to say, he was pretty dismissive about the notion of playing in that competition. And there was that bit of a shambles, really, with the first home game against Cologne, when the stand was a brilliant atmosphere. But the I mean, it was amazing. All those fans went all that way to watch that team, and they were really hopeless, Cologne, weren't they? But they
stunk, didn't they?
Yeah, very good.
Thank you.
They need to win it now, really. You know, that's their only chance. And I'm right in thinking that Atletico Madrid are probably the other big fish, really big fish left in it. But it'd be a good way for him to go out. And I think I think the chance are he will leave this summer. And what a way to go, winning a European trophy, which he's not yet. He's obviously the one thing that he's not done at Arsenal.
Just going back to the picture at the bottom, no team now in the bottom half won this weekend. 3 draws, 3 quite crucial draws. West Brom 1, Swansea 1, Brighton 1, Huddersfield 1, Bournemouth 2, Crystal Palace 2. Ian Winrow, writing in the paper, says, 2 teams trading mistakes and unable to conjure the decisive moment. That was Brighton and Huddersfield. It's not a game that's going to live long in the memory, is it?
No, I think probably Huddersfield, without wishing to be unfair on them, are one of the least prepared teams for the Premier League. They came up through the playoffs, so that's always going to give you, you know, a couple of weeks less than the two promoted teams. And they've kind of, they've bought players in a very different market to most clubs in that part of the division. Brighton, on the other hand, that was very much their kind of mantra for the seasons preceding their promotion, that they wanted to be ready for the Premier League. And I think they've, you know, they were always going to be, it was always going to be a skin of the teeth job for those two teams. But, you know, the very fact that with five, six games to go, they're still in there fighting does them great credit, I think.
Are West Brom done now? That draw ended a run of eight consecutive defeats. They're 10 points off safety with five remaining. Darren Moore now in temporary charge.
I think they are. The big question for them now is who is the next manager going to be? And obviously they're looking at someone who's a championship specialist. John Percy's written, our Midlands correspondent has written that could well be Michael Appleton, who I think would be a really good choice. Did well at Oxford, his last job before he moved over to be assistant at Leicester. And the other name that's been mentioned is Dean Smith at Brentford, who's a manager I think I really admire, who's really had to battle his way up, you know, with Walsall and now with Brentford. And both of them would be good choices.
Just a word on the Premier League's unlikely entertainers, Bournemouth. They scored an 89th minute equaliser against Palace. And now it's the seventh game in a row involving Bournemouth that's had a goal scored in the 89th minute or later. This season, they've gained 18 points from losing positions, which is the best in the Premier League. And they've lost 19 points from winning positions, which is third best in the Premier League. They're just an unlikely entertaining team, aren't they, Bournemouth? It's never a dull moment, yeah. It seems.
I mean, they're amazing in that they. I mean, I remember the sort of week that they got promoted. I mean, they were all over the radio and the newspapers, weren't they? And it was like this little miracle of this club coming from nowhere that had come all the way through the divisions with this great young manager. And now it's just expected of them. You know, Eddie Howe's not shown a great deal of interest in going anywhere else, and people have gradually stopped linking him with jobs, and he's just happy there. But I'm just looking at the team, actually, the team that played Palace. A lot of all these lads that have been with him a long time and that have served him well. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. He's got so much out of them. And if anything, really, it's the bigger names that have gone there. I mean, Ake, they've done a great job with. But he's really developed and gets so much value out of players. It's amazing when you think that Southampton have to beat them, really, to stay in the division, and Southampton for a long time was seen as the job that Howe should aspire to in order that he could. I mean, I probably wrote this myself, but
when you say probably,
yes, yeah, I'm sure I did. You know, that he could aspire to in order to get the Arsenal job or the Chelsea job or one of those jobs that English managers never ever seem to get, and yet he's kind of proved us all wrong, really, and held Bournemouth, you know, in mid table. You know, but just like Southampton, it only takes a few mistakes. It only takes some miscalculations in the transfer market, and things can be more difficult. But the one thing that Bournemouth have done, which Southampton haven't done, is they've kept the same manager, and it's worked.
Newcastle winning at Leicester and Burnley winning at Watford has put Burnley in a pretty strong position to finish in seventh place, which looks likely to give them a European spot for next year. Burnley on a European tour, as their fans have been singing. That would be an interesting prospect, wouldn't it?
It would be great. And the one thing I hope they would do, because it would be really difficult for them, just it would really stretch their resources, wouldn't it? And I mean, I don't know how many flights there are out of Burnley International Airport, or indeed if such a place exists. But they're going to have to totally rethink the way they approach the season. And there have been clubs along the way, unlikely contenders, in none as small as Burnley, but you think back to Stoke or Bolton Wanderers. Just hope they give it a go, because it would be absolutely brilliant. I think it would be a challenge for them, but hopefully one they would embrace.
Right, I'm joined on the phone now by our man on Merseyside, Chris Bascombe, to look back at a drab derby and look forward to what could be a very special night in the Champions League between Liverpool and Manchester City. So, Chris, you were at Goodison Park then on Saturday, yeah, for the Merseyside derby. What sort of a Merseyside derby was that?
Well, there are always a occasions, aren't there, where there's so much happens in a game, you just don't know how to cram it into your match report, and it's definitely fair to say this was not one of them.
So, the exact opposite, yeah.
You know, Wayne Rooney had a bit of a mutter under his breath. I think something happened in the first half, maybe something happened towards the end, and that was about it. In between, it was just very forgettable. I kind of felt Liverpool went there compromised, you know, the very... I suppose this was Jurgen Klopp's idea of caution, this kind of setup, you know, where he's gone in without his main weapons and just said to the players, control the game. I thought it was quite interesting. He said it was the most mature performance he'd seen as Liverpool manager, and that, you know, it was almost like Liverpool was going to dictate the tempo, and he did really up until the minute I felt he took James Milner off. At which point you're kind of thinking, is there anything more Jurgen can do here to give Sam Allardyce a win? I mean, he doesn't go in with Firmino and Salah. He takes Milner, who I thought, along with Van Dijk, was the best player on the pitch. Then he takes Mane off, just because he looked a bit dangerous. And Everton nearly did take advantage, but I kind of thought Everton were very, very poor, and Liverpool just did what Klopp ultimately was happy with, which is get at least a point. And in light of Chelsea's result today, it's a very, very good point for Liverpool.
We'll go into Liverpool more in a moment, Chris, but just looking at it from the Everton perspective, you've sort of focused your reports on it in the Telegraph as well. Yeah. The struggle for popularity for Sam Allardyce, I mean, what's going to happen here?
Well, it's a massive problem for Allardyce is, if I was to come on here and say, look, I think he's been a bit unlucky here because, you know, he's done the job that he was expected to do and he's inherited somebody else's team. He's not had a chance to build. I would get absolutely annihilated, you know.
Because, you just said it.
You know, exactly. Well, it's true. You know, you would get absolutely... Because the problem for him has been they didn't want him, the Everton fans. They have a different perception of where the club is going. Their idea of what they want from their club, like pretty much every fan wants, is a kind of idealistic, young, up-and-coming manager who's going to be there to build something for 4 or 5 years. And whether he likes it or he likes us saying it or not, Sam is just not seen as that figure and never will be by the Everton fans. And you kind of, I kind of like, because I've been dealing with him for the first time in my life, I kind of do respect the way he doesn't shirk any of the questions. He doesn't ignore, you know, this ongoing daily reference to he's under, you know, his position's under threat. He sort of doesn't necessarily believe it, I don't think, or he doesn't suggest he does, but there's been absolutely nothing at all from the top of the club to suggest they're not looking elsewhere and keeping their options open. And so this kind of vacuum exists at the moment, which is going to be filled by ongoing, I wouldn't call it speculation, because it's well sourced, you know, sense that something is going to be happening in the summer, which ultimately the Evertonians hope is going to be a change of manager. We're already seeing new directors of football. They're going to have, like, we've had joint managers on Merseyside once upon a time. They're going to have joint directors of football as well. I mean, they really need to decide what they're going to do. But the problem Allardyce has got is that if he's in charge at the start of next season, it's going to look as though Farhad Moshiri hasn't got a clue what he's doing, and the Everton fans are going to be ready to explode at the first poor home performance. And that is the dilemma the Everton board face, because the Everton fans just do not want Sam Allardyce as manager. It's a fact.
Chris, who do you think it's going to be if it's not going to be Sam?
Well, I've felt all along, I've had my suspicions, just because Marco Silva has not been really strongly linked with any position since he left Watford. And I find that really hard to understand or believe, other than if I'm really cynical, thinking he thinks he's got something already lined up. If he wanted them in, when was it, December, November time, I don't really see why, on the back of 5 poor games for Watford in the meantime or whatever it was, they're not going to still want him. You know, they thought they had an agreement, I think, with him. And, you know, his shadow has loomed large ever since that approach to Watford never came to fruition.
Let's move it on to Liverpool then, Chris. I mean, a 3-0 advantage they're taking into Tuesday. They rested a lot of players or players were injured and left out at the weekend against Everton. But perhaps the key question really is, how is Mo Salah?
Well, everything we're hearing is positive. After the game yesterday, Jurgen Klopp suggested he'll be okay. You know, you wonder how okay is okay. I mean, if he's 80%, I'm sure, you know, you'll never get a manager say he's not playing unless he's 100%, but I wonder if even a 75, 80% Salah will get on that pitch. It's, you know, Liverpool's season ultimately now comes down to these Champions League games, doesn't it? You kind of feel fourth is now theirs. So, you know, if there's one game, you know, there are certain games that come along where you will take the risk.
With Klopp saying that the Everton performance was perhaps the most mature since he came in, and also the improvement in defence that Liverpool have made, eight clean sheets in the last 12 matches, how capable are they of going to City and seeing this job through?
Well, I think you're going to be reading a lot about Virgil van Dijk over the last 48 hours or giving him too much away. I think he has been... It started off quite low-key brilliant, and now it's become an incredible brilliant. I mean, he has been... Yeah, I thought he was superb last week. I mean, you know, Liverpool have had 3-0 leads quite a bit in the last couple of years. I think we were doing pieces early in the season. They drew with Seville. This was pre-Van Dijk. And so whilst, you know, I'm sure we'll be reminding ourselves, you know, maybe that Seville game and Crystal Palace game a few years back when Liverpool have squandered these advantages. There's just a little steeliness about them with Van Dijk there. And I thought, again, he was brilliant on Saturday against Everton. And I think there's a calmness about Liverpool's defending now. But we also know if City get a bit of momentum, as we saw in the first half on Saturday, you know, they can rattle through the goals and rattle through the, you know, go through the gears very quickly. And you could just, one goal can become two and three before you know it. So I don't think any Liverpool supporter is going to be going to that stadium thinking the job is done. I think it's really been interesting last week. Everybody's been saying Liverpool just need to get a goal. So it's almost like an expectation City can get four. Yeah, but I think Van Dijk is essential. I think in many respects, we've been writing so much about Mane, Firmino and Salah for so long. But going into this game, I think a lot of people will be writing about Van Dijk.
OK, Chris.
Thank you for coming on.
OK. Enjoy Tuesday.
And you.
The Telegraph Total Football Podcast in association with Lion Trust, who help you head towards your financial goals. Independent thinkers who have the courage of their convictions to make investment decisions. Remember, investments can fall as well as rise.
So very little movement at the bottom of the Premier League table this weekend, but to pore over the situation in that relegation battle, I'm joined by broadcaster Kelly Cates. So Kelly, it's crowded still at the bottom. Not many wins this weekend. Have we learned anything more over this weekend?
I don't think we've learned anything that we didn't already know. I mean, I think, you know, it's just sort of working your way up the table. We know that it's pretty much gone for West Brom. We know that Stoke have really improved under Paul Lambert, but they still can't seem to find a way to win, although their fixtures kind of improve a bit between now and the end of the season. We know that Southampton can have a wobble in them. That, you know, I just think that there's enough fight. There's plenty of fight in those teams down at the bottom. I don't think, other than maybe West Brom, there are teams down there going with a whimper. But it just looks as though it's not going to be enough for so many of them. I think, you know, even you look at Palace, it's another late goal conceded. You look at Huddersfield, it's the same problems, even though he talked about the resolve in their game. And then probably from the way Swansea are playing, from that run of results when Carvajal first came in, they should be all right. And then I think you sort of have to start drawing a line now from West Ham upwards. 5 points, you know, with six games left to play, is starting to look all right. Because do you just think they'll get enough between now and the end of the season? Although they've got Manchester City, Manchester United and Arsenal to come between now and the end of the season. So having said that, I've not convinced myself.
How many points do you think it's going to take? Rafa Benitez still thinks it'll be the magic 40-point mark. Paul Lambert's talking more like it's going to be 36 points. What do you think?
I think so, probably somewhere in the middle of that. I think high 30s. It's probably going to come down to that. But then, I mean, that suggests that Southampton can get 9 points. If you say 37... then that suggests that Southampton are going to get 9 points from the next six games, which, you know, is not guaranteed. So I think you're sort of, I don't know, mid to high 30s, I think, will probably be about right.
What's going to change in the next few weeks as well as the pressure builds? Do you think certain teams may well emerge under that pressure, and do you think certain teams may well disappear under that pressure?
I think we've seen them under pressure, all these teams, at different stages of the season. And, you know, especially when they've made changes and we've seen how they've reacted to them. And, you know, West Brom really the only team that have properly crumbled under the pressure. The rest of them seem to be really responding to it. It's just that they don't have whatever it takes to, you know, to get those 3 points, whether it's that last bit of quality, they're all struggling for goals, you know, have done all season and are struggling for goals, particularly at this stage, to try and just get them over the line. And I think it's just going to be that. I don't, I can't see anything changing massively, you know, for those teams. Let's say from Stoke to Swansea, just sort of drawing an arbitrary line. I can't see anything changing massively for either of them. I think it's just going to come down to how they perform in each of the fixtures, who they've got to play against. And it's just going to be as obvious as that. I can't see there being any massive twist.
Usually you get a team that emerges, don't you, towards this sort of time. You go on a great run at the end. I just don't see who that's going to be at the moment.
The only one I could sort of, maybe two I could, because Swansea are sort of on an improved run, aren't they? The only ones I could sort of see are Crystal Palace to sort of build on that momentum from Zaha coming back, since he's come back, and really sort of kick on from that. This weekend, it's difficult to see, to judge on this weekend. Stoke, because of the improvement, I think that it might be, you know, them that managed to get the results, just because their fixtures start to even out between now and the end of the season. They've got Liverpool to come, but they've got West Ham, which is going to be a massive game for them. They've got Burnley, so Burnley now starting to get to that season, part of the season we don't really know. And they play Palace and Swansea as well, so it could be really big for Stoke. But I just think I can make a point for them going on a good run. I can make a point for Palace going a good run. And so then you're starting to look at maybe Huddersfield dropping into the bottom three. And the problem with Southampton is, as much as Mark Hughes might be a good medium to long-term appointment, he isn't someone who has ever had a good manager bounce, or has rarely had. I think I'm right in saying he's never had it, actually. He's not had a really good run of results in his first eight games anywhere. So, things would have to change drastically for him at Southampton. And given they've got to play Chelsea and City between now and the end of the season, they've also got tough trips to Leicester and to Everton. It's starting to look a little bit uncomfortable for them.
I'm going to put you on the spot now, Kelly. Who's going down? Predict the three.
West Brom. <They're> the first one.
The easy one, yeah.
I think Southampton aren't going to do it. Huddersfield have got City, Arsenal and Chelsea. I think, just to predict a change in the bottom three, I think it's going to be West Brom, Southampton and Huddersfield. I think Stoke might just squeak through. Just to predict a change, just because if I say it's going to stay the same, that's quite dull, isn't it?
That's just sitting on the fence, really, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah, pretty. Yeah, much. Exactly.
Before I let you go, Kelly, I know you're at Goodison Park for the Merseyside derby this weekend.
Yeah.
Liverpool against City on Tuesday. I mean, it was a bit of a warm-up, I suppose, for Liverpool. It was quite an easy game in some ways against Everton. So how do you see Tuesday going?
It is going to be a fantastic game. It's going to just open up hugely at the Etihad. I genuinely don't think it's all over. I think City are something like 14-1 still to win the Champions League. Every other team who's got a deficit that's similar to City's, they're out at like nearly 100-1. So I think that tells you a lot about, I think that as much as Liverpool have sort of sorted out their defence relatively since Virgil van Dijk's come in, it just tells you more about City's attacking prowess than it does about anything else. Don't make me predict it. After this weekend and after that game yesterday, that Manchester derby, I'm less comfortable predicting that game, even with Liverpool having a 3-0 advantage, than I am predicting the teams to go down.
Okay, I'll let you scurry away then. Thanks, Kelly.
I'm running away with my tail between my legs and absolutely not making any predictions on that.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, dear.
So that's the football world put to rights, and as usual we'll finish with our hero of the week, which takes us back to the Etihad Stadium, and it's the tale of two stewards. At one end of the joy spectrum was a fun vacuum who tried to stop Paul Pogba celebrating with his own fans at the end of the game, and at the other end is the Manchester City steward who had the biggest smile in Manchester. He enjoyed Manchester United's winner even more than Chris Smalling. If anyone knows who he is, please let us know. Be very interested to find out. So Sam, a steward related story is the one in your repertoire?
I have scratched around for one and I can't think of one, but I've got a good ball boy one.
Okay.
Which is as close as I can get. And this was a ball boy who was at Wembley, March 28th, 1990, England against Brazil. It was actually the last time England beat Brazil until Roy Hodgson beat them.
Okay.
And that ball boy was me.
Wow.
Never touched the ball. Never touched the ball. Got gobbed at, I think, a couple of times for getting in people's way, but did manage to sort of sidle up the touchline when Gascoigne came on to stand as close to him as I could, and he was
in awe of you.
Slightly manic, I think, before he came on, really nervous, and England won. Brazil should have got a penalty, blatant handball by Stuart Pearce, and at the end we were told go onto the pitch and line up on the centre circle. There's going to be a presentation. to the players, but all the Brazilian players just walked straight off because they were so fed up with this decision. So, and the England players went off as well. So a few of us were just boys from Stevenage were just left stood in the centre circle while the old Empire Stadium emptied.
You could be a lucky charm, though. Gareth Southgate, if you're listening, get him on the plane. That's all from this week's Total Football. Thank you for your company. Tom Gibbs will be back next week for an end-of-season glory run. In the meantime, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts as well. Our theme tune is by Polvo. You can find their back catalogue at mergerecords.com. Thanks to Tayo Papula on the buttons, and thank you as well. I'll talk to you again soon. Ta-ra.
The Telegraph Total Football Podcast, in association with Lion Trust, specialist fund managers.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.